Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation Second Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Tape number 5. Continuation, session number 2, Special Clinical Problems.
There is Sybil Cole, also from Institute of Rehabilitation and Research. Oh, that's right, okay. You're still in Houston?
I'm still in Houston. Okay, there was just one black slide. Since Dr. Smith and Dr. Halstead and I have all worked together, we decided to put all the slides in one tray. The work that I am going to be presenting is based on the patient population that we served during the outpatient polio program at TIER. What I would like to say is that each of us who are here are trying to fit the pieces together in order to understand and remedy the problems that various people are coming and presenting to us, the same way that some museums, unfortunately, have to deal with an overload of beautiful pieces, but they're kind of disorganized, and we don't know how to put them all together so that we can appreciate their beauty and make them work for us. While some of you are going to continue to focus on unraveling the reasons for the symptoms that the people are supporting, others of us are confronted with having to recommend treatment modalities based on limited data. It's my small part in this piece of the puzzle, as requested by Dr. Halstead when I joined his clinic team, that I was to identify the emotional responses, behaviors, and attitudes that were facilitating or impeding the incorporation of the medical and physical therapy recommendations. I think that we again need to focus on the fact that this is a self-referred population, and so the information may be very different than other surveys where people were not initially identifying complaints themselves. I'm not going to deal with everything that's on each of the slides, but because of time, just highlight the ones that I think are most important. Oh, thank you. I thought I was already over. Okay. I think that personality styles really are important. People have talked about previous psychiatric disturbances or whether someone's manic depressive or someone's obsessive compulsive. That's going to be very important for you to know in order to be able to plan the type of approach and the rapidity with which you're going to present expectations for change. Pain is extremely important because of the amount of energy that is consumed by that individual. And if the pain is not first controlled, we cannot expect that people are going to free up energy to be creative and to be able to participate with us in problem solving. The addictions have been very, very difficult for us to deal with. We've had people who have been chain smokers for 20 to 30 years and then come and present with respiratory, cardiac, and circulatory problems, but they are not as yet willing to stop smoking. That's not a psychosocial problem. That's a behavior pattern problem, and to get them coaxed into an addiction treatment has been very, very important and sometimes becomes my primary task in interfacing with the individual. Some difficulty with alcohol, although we found more that the spouses of the patients coming were more apt to be alcoholics rather than the individuals themselves. And that, I thought, was unique to this patient population. The eating disorders needed to be determined not only in terms of poor caloric intake and nutritional deficits, but also when weight reduction programs were suggested, there often were times that the obesity really had nothing to do with a weight reduction program per se, but really had to be looked at as a separate issue because it was an indicator of poor self-esteem. And the underlying reasons for that poor self-esteem were going to have to be treated before we were going to expect that the person was really going to be successful in any type of weight reduction program. Sleep disorders were also a major problem because it, again, sapped energy, made people more irritable, reduced their memory and problem-solving abilities. The marital and parent-child relationships are very complex, and I don't want to do them a disservice by dealing with them superficially, so I won't deal with them at all except in my written paper. the expectations that the people universally came with to the clinic was that we were going to have a cure. There was a post-polio program. That mean we had all of the answers, and we were going to be able to tell them exactly what to do to fix all of their problems. We were going to be able to extinguish all of their pain by giving them one medication or one exercise regime. And that was going to be it. That was all that was going to need to be involved. Their goal was to regain their lost strength and to return to their previous level of functioning. They would negotiate with us and say, well, okay, I'll slow down for a little bit just to rest my muscles, but then my real goal is to get back up to what I've been doing for the past 20 years. And basically, there wasn't really a willingness or an expectation that they were going to have to do major internal modifications themselves. So I'd be very interested to hear about Dr. Patton's patient who did this marvelous self-imposed psychosocial personality reorganization. I think that was your term. Sounded fantastic. Dysfunctional assumptions is my term and got real rave reviews and reactions at our Houston conference. But basically, it was important for me to find out what kinds of attitudes these people had that were keeping them in a pattern that was really self-destructive. I mean, most people, if you have pain, you just start doing things to avoid it, and yet these people were not willing to do that. Basically, hard work cured polio. The more active they were, the more they regained function. And for them, and that was just an absolute ingrained idea. It was only physical activity that improved strength, because only as they participated and were more physically active in their recovery process did they improve. Increased strength was the ultimate goal, and they really did not understand the difference between strength versus endurance versus function. Although they had mastered it and had learned how to do things with greater endurance and with function, they really did not understand the difference, and that was another reason why they were always asking for exercises, because they felt that was the only way that they were once again going to regenerate their strength. The other focus and attitude, and this was really not always totally, but a great majority of these people had been forced by their families or communities to discard adaptive equipment, that it was only there for a period of time, and that once they were cured, they didn't need that adaptive equipment anymore. There was also a total focus on productivity, that the more you did, the better you were, the better person you were, the better you were going to be loved, and the more acceptance you were going to have. And for some people, that became a total fusion. They were only worthy if they were productive. And if they were no longer productive, and if they slowed down, they were no longer going to be worthy. And some women were even fearful, and husbands were fearful that they were going to be abandoned. So I think that we need to be very careful in understanding what this set of attitudes and assumptions are when we're making recommendations to people, and don't challenge their self-image too immediately. Some of the lifestyles in terms of perceptions that also require change. Thank you. were activity level, which they needed to be able to look at the quality versus the quantity of that activity level. The use of the term limitations for disability, and I think it's very important that we're all very careful about the language that we use, and we use the language that is comfortable to the person that we're working with. There is no use in a confrontation situation with having them use the term being disabled, being handicapped. You never really faced up to the fact that you were disabled, and that's why you're having these problems now. I would find that people just being presented with an application for a handicap sticker would stop listening and wouldn't have heard any of the other recommendations. So I think we need to be very sensitive to what is going to facilitate, what language we use will facilitate or terminate our ability to interface with these people. Again, the symbolic meaning of adaptive equipment, and support systems. I think that we need to be a little bit careful, because I don't think that the support groups are appropriate for every single person, and some of the support groups are being drained by people who really need individual psychiatric and probably group therapy rather than a group support, which is more of an empathy, a ventilation, and a creative problem-solving situations. So I don't think that that should necessarily be a universal recommendation. The interventions in order to achieve these are, and Dr. Smith has mentioned these already, for activity level is an education of the body's response so that people can really understand what it is that their body has been doing all of these years. Many people had a very, very poor idea of what the residual impairments were of polio. They knew their body, but they didn't understand exactly what had happened to it. In terms of limitations, being able to identify the options that they had in terms of being able to do some of the same activities, but possibly not as frequently or not in the same manner. For giving adaptive equipment recommendations that had to do with things that were going to be permanently attached to themselves, we needed to spend a great deal of time in paced clinic visits, and Dr. Halstead already mentioned that it often needed to be over a span of time in order to gain people's trust for them to actually follow through. People would accept lumbar rolls or shoes or different types of chairs very easily, but something that was going to be attached to them permanently that was going to signify to the world that they had a disability required much more time for them to emotionally accept. And then for them to identify the support systems that were going to reinforce change. Of these techniques, I just want to focus on a couple of them, since I'm running out of time. One is to push to avoid pain. Most of the people have the perception that by a reduction in their activity level, we are asking them to give in and to give up. I don't know anything more energy consuming than to push yourself into an iron lung at night or into a pneumowrap and not sleep next to your spouse. That is not giving in to anything. For them to have to do these things or to push themselves into a wheelchair or to push themselves into using a brace, that was very active energy, and they were not being compliant. They were not just giving in. So that was a very important attitudinal change and technique for me to identify, have people identify to use. The other thing was the blank pad technique. Many of these people were compulsive list makers of everything that they had to do, and then they would cross off three or four and then be overwhelmed at the end of the day about everything they had never accomplished. So I said, don't make lists. At your bedside at night, take a blank piece of paper and write down everything that you did. And give yourself a great big pat on the back for everything that you did do and everything that you accomplished. I was trying to substitute a positive feedback for a negative feedback. It's a very simple technique. It would take me on the average of 3 clinic visits to get somebody to agree to do this. Some of you may be more persuasive. And the other thing is in terms of labeling feelings. I think many people who have gone through polio have really done such a good job at being normal that they don't perceive themselves as having a disability, they don't perceive themselves as being different from anyone else, and regardless of the number of adaptive pieces of equipment that they used, since that they functioned that way for 20 to 30 years, that was normal. And there was no need for us to try to have them go through some sort of cathartic experience unless that was something that they were feeling at the time. And some of the people did feel that and did need to have a catharsis, but I don't think that it's necessary to label for everyone to have to label their feelings and adjustment to situations. I think that they can bypass that if they'll change the behavior. These are the goals that we set up. Primary was to establish a trusting relationship. The staff was a resource person so that people would continue to come back, that we would help them to prioritize their options so that they knew that there were choices, and if they didn't do certain things, that maybe there were other things to do. That we would help them to expand their support system and identify people that would listen to them and help them. To always provide printed information, we would have patients be seen by a physician, one or two physicians, a social worker, a physical therapist, sometimes an occupational therapist, a nurse, a nutritionist. I mean, it was unbelievable. And all of this information was given verbally. So we finally got smart enough, after we had a visiting psychologist come and observe all of our frantic behaviors, who said, why don't you write down all of the suggestions on a summary sheet and give it to the patient when they leave so then they'll really know what it is that you told them. Okay? Thank you.
Dick Sprott from the NIA. One of the things that kind of intrigues me, which you alluded to slightly in part of your presentation, was the number of these people who felt that they had to remain productive in order to remain loved and so on.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree, your talk somewhat implies that that maybe is irrational and gets in the way. To what degree is it not irrational? To what degree does it reflect their actual situation? How many of the families, in fact, push them in that direction and will treat them differently if the family views their activities as giving up?
Okay. Let me start from the other side. Okay. The person who fuses their self-identity and self-worth with what they produce as that only aspect that has value piles that up on a void. I mean, it doesn't have any building blocks. If you feel good about yourself because you've grown up in a secure family, because there are other attributes that are valued, and you have an intrinsic self-worth separate from what it is that you produce either in school or professionally, okay, that does not, when someone then suggests that you don't produce as much, that does not shock you and it doesn't shake your self-image and self-definition. I think that the majority of families did a lot of that pushing because that they thought that was the best way to help people to be mainstream. And a lot of people do credit their families with that push and the support for their success. Okay. Some of the families then would feel very comfortable in supporting people to do less. They really did not mind people delegating. Yes, there were a few families where that indeed was a reality problem. But for the majority, people were much more supportive than the individual was willing to give them credit for. And it was more their difficulty in terms of their loss of self-worth.
I have a question and a comment, too. Relative to your question about the support, or your statement about the support groups, I guess my experience has been that I agree with you on one level that certainly not everyone, a support group is not appropriate for everyone. And there definitely are people who need individual counseling, you know, supportive counseling at different levels, including psychiatric care. On the other hand, on a general basis, I think that the support groups have been as beneficial as many professionals could be with the same amount of time, because one advantage of support groups is it does happen slowly. People have time to integrate ideas, and there's a lot of reinforcement on the education and a lot of ability to discuss on a layperson's level the implications of some of the information that we're trying to pass on to them. We have a support group network now in Michigan of over 15 local support groups, and they keep growing. Like every month there's another community that has started another support group. It's quite phenomenal. And I think the thing that's keeping them going is that people do feel that there's, you know, a benefit that they get. And I think the benefit is largely in their lifestyle adaptations. You know, they share with each other what has worked for them.
Can I respond to that?
Please, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to be hung by the support group system because I'm certainly a total advocate. I was talking about the damage to the support system of the individual who goes in and drains the support system. That's what I was talking about in terms of us as professionals who might be able to help get someone directed to other ways of getting the help that they need, because we've had several people who have either become suicidal or they bring all of the family problems. And then here are people who are trying to deal with reality problems on their own that they don't have any energy. The support group needs to go for exactly what you said, but should not be an attempt for other people to go, because then it gets drained and is not permitted to perform its important service and function.
You almost have to train the support group leaders to recognize when to refer. The other question I had was about stress. You didn't really mention much on stress management, and it seemed to me that you mentioned it in passing in terms of both the physical stresses and emotional stresses. But I guess in my experience, that's been one of the most major issues. Financial stresses, I would also raise as another one. The implications on people's jobs and their ability to earn money and support their family, which does get down to productivity and self-worth again, but has been enormous problems. Legal consultation concerning disability benefit management or obtaining disability benefits from employers that look on post-polio syndrome as not real. Is a major stress again.
If you want to give me an hour, I'll go into detail on everything.
Peter Garrow, New Zealand, this relates also to the stress in your selection bias and getting sort of type A people who want to achieve something, and how stressed these people are at the thought of not being able to control their environment. So rest or reducing activity is tremendously stressful, and Frankenhauser has showed how adrenaline levels actually go up in this group. And one of the problems is with stressed, anxious people is they can't perceive their own efforts accurately. So it's either flat out or stop. And this can be one of the problems of any sort of graded prescribed exercise program. Perhaps your comments.
The term stress usually brings so many different ideas to different people that I tend not to use it, because we each are then talking about something else. What I try to do is pick up specific terminology that I think is regular English that each of us can understand and then in some way help. The people who become so focused on producing, the stress there, I think, is multifaceted. Okay, I think that it has to do with self-image. I think it has to do with status in the community. It has to do with earning power. And it has to do with fear of old age. So that in order to present a paper and to be able to get at each of those things, I mean, you've mentioned three things which I could probably speak about for 10 minutes, and I'll be glad to do that informally. But I agree with you. I don't know about the adrenaline levels, except where mine is right now.
Thank you. Is there one more question? We're going to try and end our session then.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No, we have one more. That's right. One more paper before the closing session. Right. Excuse me, Joe.
Joe Calford from Manitoba.
I was going to ask a question, of Sybil, because in doing life histories with people that we picked out in epidemiological studies, many of the trends that she talked about occurred both in their recall of their post-acute experience and also in dealing with the late polio aging, particularly the sort of mastery of time and task orientation. But the other thing that comes out in life history interviews is that a lot of that was imposed by their early contacts with the rehabilitation system. And renewal of contact means that you've got to renegotiate those kinds of issues. That it isn't just the individual that's become task-oriented and pacing. It's very much their interaction with us at the time they came in as acute care patients, at the time they reactivate their contact with the medical care system. Many of these same factors are operative. What I'd like to do in this paper is examine the impact of some of the changes in respiratory support technology on the quality of life and the current experience of aging effects among a selected subsample of the larger group that we talked about 2 years ago in the Manitoba follow-up study. We did the medical record audits, and we did two surveys tracing first the people that were in iron lungs, the 186 people. Whoops, sorry, I'll take it back. The 186 people who were at one time in iron lungs, and then went on to look at the other larger non-respiratory cohort using some of the same design methodology, but not the clinical follow-up that the Mayo program has used. What we've been doing more recently is on the other side of the flowchart, which is to try to understand the meaning of epidemiological survey information on late aging and adaptation effects by talking to representative people in real detail. These are often 10 or 15 hours of interviews in which a person talks about both their early rehabilitation and adaptation experience and their more recent experience with late post-polio aging effects. What we are doing in this is only talking about 10 cases, of whom all included people that were dependent on respirators 10 hours a day or more. The objective was to combine this qualitative view of life history with the results of epidemiological analysis to try to understand both aging and adaptation for those that have not lived in isolation of technology. They've been in contact with the kind of program that Dr. Alba and Dr. Cook described. They've been people that have been in continuous contact with programs like El Rancho, and we can't deal with their aging experience or their current utilization of services without looking at the context of their more detailed life history. What we tried to do is to look at these 10 people starting out with the same kind of case presentation that you saw on the on the New York patients. The five individuals who had a history of respiratory dependence and had lived most of their lives as inpatients. And we tried to look at the variation in technology that they had experienced during their own lives, not so much from a technical ventilation standpoint, but in terms of living day-to-day with technology and experiencing technology change and how they were using technology as they responded to late respiratory effects themselves. These are just timelines showing the five people that lived most of their lives as inpatients. These are five more individuals using the same diagram who had more experience in respiratory home care kinds of situations. What taking a description of the people's lives in this way, which is not too different than the one that you saw for the respirator users in New York, and combining it with an attempt to look at other life events, not always medical kinds of things, the loss of a spouse, a major medical emergency in a spouse, and also to look at life history interviews as a way for understanding the changing environment of care, the fact that a respirator user may be very significantly influenced by an environmental event like the entitlement to 24-hour attendance benefits if they're taking a particular form of respiratory technology. So what we did is looked at a series of what sociologists call life careers. And we had already done some of the epidemiological looking that we reported in the last meeting. We looked at the progression through a variety of mechanical support methods, and we looked at the spirometry for each one of these individuals. We had already done some of the epidemiology in our published work on the whole cohort of people that were in iron lungs. We saw in the epidemiological statistics that we published last time some aging effects, but what it was very difficult to do was to relate those aging effects to the kinds of complicated adaptation patterns that people that were using four or five different methods of mechanical ventilation over a 30-year period. And so what we did is used a historian's timeline. We really did what are called life event analysis, and tried to do a biography of a person's experience in using ventilation equipment during their acute period, during early episodes of respiratory decline, and during their most recent post-polio experience. This is just a single person's timeline. You can't see it very well, but it's like the line that a historian uses, and what it really does is show a graph of mechanical dependence down the side between 0 and 24 hours, and it's a single person's career starting with the onset of respiratory paralysis in the major epidemics. The fact that she was placed in a major centralized treatment center in which all respiratory cases in Manitoba had a very profound effect on the kind of life course that she had. Other kinds of programs that you see along the bottom line there, the fact that Manitoba had among the first respiratory home care programs in the mid-50s in Canada. And then the beginning of secondary medical events, a Harrington rod operation in which he experienced respiratory complications, went back onto the iron lung, went through a new period of weaning. The kind of thing that Sybil has just talked about in her own interviews about what rehabilitation meant to her current adaptation had a great deal to do with learning the rehab ethic, and yet finding that today didn't work very well as she needed to depend on more and more hours and to move to positive pressure experience. Even her acceptance of a trach was very much dependent upon that early experience of decline and weaning. The next decade of her life, again, a series of discharge to home, a series of experimentation with alternate forms of respiratory support, and then a series of external events. Provision of totally comprehensive medical insurance in Canada had a major impact on her own psychosocial adaptation. The final decade is the one that we've tended to focus on in looking at late polio aging effects. From about 1970 on, she had a series of progressive rehospitalizations and respiratory insufficiency. But these were all conditioned by her earlier experiences. She's recently undergone a whole series of other kinds of experiences that were really family life events. an infarction in a spouse, the withdrawal of 24-hour coverage for double attendant services. And yet, in looking at her spirometry as a medical case, if we don't look at the other psychosocial side and the life events that go along with it, we're only dealing with half of her case. All 10 of the life histories that we did have their own unique characteristics, but the thing that we found, I think, that is perhaps the thing that we'll close with, was that technology use in people's adaptation to late post-polio aging effects was very much influenced by previously adapted patterns, and therefore people's experience in weaning from iron lungs was critical in terms of the way they saw the new technology that we were proposing. The kinds of things that we saw didn't always relate to mechanical acceptance of particular new technology, but it had also to do with the way people paced their lives. And we found three prevalent features in all of these people that we interviewed. One was a selective allocation of activities using limited energy resources, and people's willingness to go on to more efficient forms of ventilation very much related to how much they saw themselves being able to selectively allocate without going on to higher levels of technology. Pacing activities, estimating energy levels and matching levels to activity, shortcutting, finding low energy routes to do it. In terms of people's adaptation to each new form of respiratory support technology, the kinds of things that life history interviews yielded were those of coming to terms with the trach if they used it, dealing with visual stigma of the airway, developing skills of breathing and talking with the machine, locating the primary care's giver's own willingness, either their spouses or the caregivers that they paid, their ability to adapt to more and more complex equipment and with levels of risk and reliability associated with that equipment. And finally, coming to terms with a series of trade-offs that new technology involved. Very often we hear a respirologist that will present only the benefits of more accurate ventilation. And I think the bottom line that we really found, to summarize, was that people really saw the impact of technology as one of costs and benefits. And each move to a new form of ventilation and a more efficient form of ventilation, they could give you an inventory that perhaps lasted 15 minutes of the advantages and disadvantages of loss of control in some sectors, of secondary impacts on the caregivers that they were working with. My only plea is that we not decontextualize the technical medical experience of late polio aging or the treatment that we give people, but that we also bring in the kind of thing that Sybil has talked about as a clinician in terms of trying to understand these as major life changes.
In dedication to you, I will read a quote. This is Sybil Cole, that a patient gave to me because I think it epitomizes your talk. "And what is as important as knowledge?" asked the mind. "Caring and seeing with the heart," answered the soul. Thank you very much.
Five-thirty isn't the best time for a psychosocial presentation. Yeah, we're given prime time as usual.
Antel Montreal, and perhaps it's late in the day to ask this kind of question, and you've discussed patients with extreme problems with polio and that elegant presentation from the evaluation of the patients from Houston. Many of us who are in the clinical business, neurology, I guess rehabilitation, I can only talk for neurology, to supply this comprehensive kind of evaluation requires mobilization of tremendous amount of resources and planning to be able to bring such programs into bearing. While we're being asked to see so many patients, can you give us, and my experience comes from dealing with patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis rather than polio, so I'm asking, I guess, of the people that walked in the door at your institute, how many of them do you think were I guess they all benefit, so it's a wrong choice of word, but how many of them really took advantage of all that you were offering, acknowledged that they were benefiting, or in fact do a majority of these patients simply have to need the are really asking for the physical things that we supply, the bracing, et cetera. I'll ask both of you that.
Let me, Laura, why don't you respond first? Because
Laura Halstead, no longer from Houston. You're asking some good questions about how to set up a polio clinic, what are the major elements, and then what's the impact? And it took a lot of experience before we got our feet on the ground and had a good sense of what it was we wanted to deliver. It doesn't happen the first day. And I was blessed by having some excellent people, some of whom you heard today, Dr. Laura Smith and Sybil Cole. And I'm very grateful to them for the many things they've taught me about the management of polio. The number of people who I think were helped is going to be hard to assess. Some people did come and want to have just validation that they were having a new problem. That was probably the largest group. And just a walk in the door and be accepted and have someone say, I understand what you're going through, and not be discounted, to have their symptoms validated, was just very powerful medicine. And for a lot of folks, I think they came, they heard that, and didn't come back. There are a number of folks, and I don't have percents on this, but there are a number of folks who had to come several times to hear that message, who, as Dr. Smith has mentioned, desperately needed a brace. We all knew that on the first visit, but it's the last thing they wanted to hear. And so we learned over a period of time not to talk about bracing or about a motorized cart or a wheelchair. What we did was establish rapport and trust with the patient. We demonstrated that we could, in fact, make their lives more comfortable with a very simple device like a lumbar roll or whatever to help their posture. When they realized we knew what we were doing, then we might say, hey, a short leg brace would really make your posture better, make you walk more comfortably, and make you less fatigued. So those are the kind of things that I think eventually sold us to them.
I think also in response to your question about the resource, you can have programs like the one that started in Manitoba, where we had a group of older clinicians that had a baseline register that allowed us to do good follow-up research, but not until very recently, a generation of young clinicians that were willing to take that register or the case finding and baseline research that was done at Houston or is now being done at Mayo and with a clinical follow-up. And I think that there's a real dilemma of needing both of those kinds of things. That we established some pretty good data on central Canadian cases, but we didn't have a group of clinically oriented researchers or a clinical facility that could provide the follow-up. We raised the question by doing a survey, but the ethical question is, do you also not need to then move to the clinical program? And one of the resource issues is, do you have a generation of clinicians with the interest that are willing to take that challenge up as happened in Houston?
Yeah, I was going to answer that. I would say that 50% of the people that I saw would say that I was absolutely of no help to them. One of the ethics of recovering from polio was that you did it by yourself, except for your physician and your physical therapist. Social workers were notorious as hinderers. So I had to do a lot of selling. Those people who would say that I did help them were people who were in such severe psychological pain and so lost that we could identify specific psychosocial issues to work on. And then the same way they would perceive you as helpful. Also, I did not continue to see every single person every time they came back. There was a selection process, as with the physical therapist, also, and as with the physician, so that on some follow-up visits, patients would come in and only be seen by selective team members, or they would only go for outpatient PT or OT or see me in conjunction with one of those visits, but not necessarily have to come back through the whole clinic. Another problem with social work service or PT or OT service is that it's not financially reimbursed. The physician visit will tend to always be reimbursed. So I think that you're looking at financial as well as emotional comfort.
Thank you, Sybil Cole.
Thank you, Sybil Cole. Right, okay. I think we'll now go ahead and end our afternoon session with our erudite closing remarks here by our discussant, Dr. Patton.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.